Okay, so with pointing, we were at something that I call really low level. Low level doesn't mean interesting, not interesting, or anything. It's just that it's looking at very basic phenomena. I want to jump to something a lot higher level that has to do with this interaction models that I briefly talked about. So this is work that I have done for the past 10 years. And essentially, I've always been frustrated by the fact that the user interfaces we use today, desktop, have not changed in 30 years now. And it can't be that there isn't a better way. So what I did is observe, this was like 15 years ago now, that interfaces, applications were getting bloated. And I did a little study where I took a number of existing applications. At the time, it was all on the Macintosh, Word version 6, Excel number 5, Persuasion, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a PowerPoint-like thing, Photoshop version 4, Mark Express version 3, Canvas version 3, Canvas has disappeared. It was a drawing program. And I measured, I just counted things, number of menus, number of commands in each menu, number of dialog boxes, number of submenus, number of commands in those submenus, number of items in those submenus that lead to a dialog box. And then I totaled all these things. It's not exactly the total, because if a menu leads to a submenu, I don't count the main command as a command itself. But I came to these numbers that says that around 1997, and I would like to do the same measure again today, but I don't have the patience. But 15 years ago, a typical productivity app had over 100 different commands. About 65% of them were leading to a dialog box, which was itself full of other things. And the tool palettes, which were starting to become common at the time, had, from 60 to over 100 tools. And if you put this in relation with the 7 plus or minus 2 magic number from Miller, there is kind of a mismatch there. We have applications that have an incredible visual complexity. I'm not even talking here about operating them, but you open Word today, it's mind-boggling. If you've never seen it before, I mean, you want to run away screaming. The other thing I did is counting what happens from one version to the next. So I did this for Excel, for Word, and for Photoshop. And everything, almost everything increases. Word 5 to Word 6, interestingly, number of commands are pretty stable, but 25% more lead to dialog box. So something you did in one step, you have to do now in 2, 3, or more steps. Number of tools in the toolbars doubled. In Excel, they had done the transition to toolbars before, so it was pretty stable. And in fact, they had simplified somewhat the menus. Although overall, there were no submenu in Excel 4, and there were 15 of them in Excel 5. So you see that there is a trend there. And you can put it in graphs. I want to go quickly over this to get to the meat of this talk. Now, the thing is, when you design this type of tool, you have this trade-off. You want the thing to be powerful so that it can be used for everything, and you can sell it to the most possible number of people. But you also want it to be simple. But that's a trade-off that you cannot resolve. You have to make choices. Either you're going to make things that are fairly simple to use but have low power, or things that, simple but not powerful, or hard to use but very powerful. And so you try to surf on this wave and decide where you want to be. So, the thing is,
if you look at the evolution of software, there's evolution towards bloatware. Designers don't do their work, they put more stuff in the application, and then the user has to figure out how to use it. They had menu commands, dialog boxes, they had programming with macros and scripting, and it's becoming harder and harder to use these tools. And then because it's becoming harder and harder, we say, well, we're going to add wizards to make it simpler again. Well, I don't know if you've ever met Clippy or one of his friends. They don't tend to work. They're great when they really think like you, but it's pretty rare. And when they don't, it's very hard to fix. The other thing that you see is more and more preferences, menus, and things, customization. So that it's you who have to really design your application. With the idea that I'm giving you the power to make your own choices, this is fine, but studies have shown that people don't do that. And when they go into preference panels, it's not to tune the applications to your need. If you do that, I remind you again, you are nerds. You're not normal people. Normal people don't go into preferences. They only do it when they are being forced to use a new version and they're trying to figure out how to make it work that, like the last one. So the thing is that the simple things, the things that used to be simple, become harder. When you have a menu item that becomes a dialog box, it becomes harder. And the complex things don't get used because people are not interested in learning them. So you had the cost of learning, and you had the cost of making choices among a larger and larger set of things of which you're using a smaller and smaller part. So what you see is some people specialize their software lineup. I mean, it's amazing you have one and only one version of Word. I mean, you know, you take any other business, you have lines of products. If you try to buy a car, even if you take one brand and one segment, there are, you know, models, and for each model you can still pick the color and the, which kind of, you know, engine and things like this. So it's amazing that software that is so malleable to make, the manufacturing cost is zero. The initial development is expensive, but then making copies costs zero. And yet, we have much less variability in the software offering than we have in any physical device, be it a toaster, a car, or even a plane. So this is to me, it's incomprehensible. But then, you know, I'm not a business person, so I'm sure some of you here in the CIE program will be able to explain this to me at the end of your entrepreneurship course. So what you start seeing is, like Apple has iPhoto and iMovie for normal people, and they have Aperture and Final Cut Pro for professionals. And you know that if you're going to use this, you're going to have to learn them, and there are people who make a living selling training for certainly Final Cut. But then Final Cut is used in any professional video production suite. But for the rest of us, it's iMovie and iPhoto, and it does, you know, the simpler things. Although even if you look at just iMovie or iPhoto, it has become progressively more and more complex. But at least they acknowledge the fact that you can be here or here, but you cannot be here. Well, what I want is actually get my pie and eat it, or get the butter and the change from the butter, as we say in France. Anyway, I want to push the curve. I want to say, well, there is still a trade-off, but for the same simplicity, I want to be able to get a bit more power. Or I want to be able to get the same level of power with a little bit more simplicity. So still keep this trade-off in mind, but push the curve. And there are interfaces that show that. This is Bryce. A very old system, I don't know if it still exists, for doing 3D modeling of landscapes. And, well, first it has a very different looking interface, okay, that's one thing. But this is, for example, something where you have 100 parameters that you can control, but it doesn't look like it's that hard. I mean, you have to know about materials and all the vocabulary there, but visually it's not as daunting as, say, the word dialog box for setting the parameters of a paragraph. And in fact, if I look at my measures on this Bryce tool, I see very smaller number than the average of all the tools I looked at before. Even though this tool is sophisticated, but it made some design choices to simplify things by having no windows, no dialog boxes, no menus, and having a layered approach. When you use Bryce, in the beginning you have only a few things, and as you use it, new features appear, which is, I think, an interesting approach. So what we did is we were confronted to a problem, which was to redesign a tool for editing color patronets. Now, color patronets are diagrams where we have circles, boxes, and arrows that can only go from a round to a square or from a square to a round. And the round, which are called places, can contain tokens that can then move in that network. And this is used, this is really a visual programming language and is used for specifying parallel systems and in particular things like telecommunication protocols. They had a graphical tool to edit those diagrams, but they wanted us to redo it, to do a new version, because theirs was 10 years old, and starting to not work very well. And so we did, and we made some radical decisions. We said, we're going to use two hands. That's radical. Well, I don't know, I mean, most people have two hands. However, most people have one mouse. So we put a mouse on one side of the keyboard, and we put a trackball on the other, and we created two-handed interaction. And we had people try it, and every single one of them said, are you sure I can do that? And after 1 minute, they wanted to steal the trackball. We created an interface that combines multiple ways of doing the same things without them running into each other's. So we have contextual menus, we have floating palettes, these you know. We have also tool glasses. A tool glass is a palette that is transparent. I move it with my left hand, and with my right hand I can click through. So I bring the tool I want to use to the place I want to use it, and I click through the palette, and I use my two hands like I use with a ruler or when I do a drawing with French curves and things like this. And in general, we have bimodal interactions. So I could, for example, move an object in the window with one hand and pan the content of the window with my other hand. Usually you have to do this with one hand, which makes you make things in sequence. By making them in parallel, it got more efficient and in fact more intuitive. So here's the interface. The graphics are not great. We're not graphic designers. We had a tab interface back in 1998. I don't think the tabs in web browsers existed at the time. These are our marking menus, which are our pop-up menus, which are, of course, circular, as you know now, three times faster. This is a tool palette, and this is a tool glass. It's transparent. I can click through to apply this color blue to this object, or this color red to that object. And so we had an interface without menu bars, without title bars, without scroll bars, without dialog boxes, without even selection. You didn't ever need to select an object before working with it. All the interaction techniques were contextual. So either you bring a menu by right-clicking on the object, or you bring a tool glass over it to use it. And we made studies that showed that the system was better than the previous system. And the real point of this is to sell you the notion of the interaction model that is behind this. And an interaction model is something where you try to gather a set of principles, rules, and properties to help you design the interface. And what you want is to be able to describe things. You want the model to help you evaluate your design, if it's good, not good, for a particular task. It
But the most important thing is you want it to be generative. You want it to help you to invent new solutions. Because once you have several solutions, we know how to compare them. We have tools for that, even though it takes time. But the problem is, where do you get the new ideas from? And you cannot just sit in a room and watch the ceiling and the ideas come to you. If you have principles that help you invent new solutions, it allows you to explore what we call the design space a lot more. So I've already shown these slides about the problems with direct manipulation. And I just want to introduce this notion of instrumental interaction. Now, with direct manipulation, we've been told that we could directly interact with the objects of interest. But we all know that, in fact, this is not true. We know that we go through all these menus and dialog boxes and things, and we rarely touch the objects, really. Now, in the real world, in real life, we use tools all the time. You use pens to write. You use a fork to eat. You use a car to move. And in fact, the history of really the human species is about creating instruments or tools to augment our capabilities. When you've seen the opening sequence of 2001, where the monkey, it's actually a chimp, throws a bone in the air and, no, I haven't seen. What are you watching?
Changed into a spaceship.
Yes. No, but the thing is that he discovered that this bone could be used
as a weapon.
Now, we've been very good as humans at creating weapons. And weapons are, you know, tools as well. But I'm not interested in those tools. Our world is populated with tools that we use to augment our capabilities. And so I took the approach of saying, well, why isn't that the case that in an interface we don't have this metaphor? Why don't we have actual tools? Well, we do have some. You know, when I have a tool palette with something that looks like a pair of scissors to cut objects, or something that looks like, color, things where I can dip the color of the palette, it is kind of tool-like. But it's not the main metaphor that is used in those interfaces. And so I introduced this notion of instrument. The reason I like to call it instrument rather than tool, I use the two really interchangeably, is because when you think instrument, to me, it evokes a musical instrument. A musical instrument is something you have to practice. It's something you have to get skilled at. And I like this notion that our systems should allow us to become expert at things. This notion that everything has to be usable instantly by a four-year-old and that's it, is really limiting the power of systems we use today. I mean, I think a system that you can use without having ever seen it before is fine. But you also want it to allow you to do sophisticated things, to be really good at it, and to get skilled. Because that is also part of what humans are good at, is learning and becoming good at a few things. You want to be, you know, average at a zillion things, but you also want people to be good at a few things. And this notion of instrument, in particular musical instruments, I think, works well. It's true also of things like, you know, if you are a woodworker, you use, you know, many different tools, and you're very picky about the tools you use, or if you're an artist and you're painting. So in those areas, the instruments are really extremely important to pursuing your work. So the way I introduce an instrument is to say, well, think of a scroll bar. Well, you can think of a scroll bar as something that someone has decided to put on the screen for you to see parts of the document that are not visible in the window. Well, I'm saying, yes, but really, the scroll bar is a navigation instrument that we don't need in the real world, because in the real world, we are not in situations where things are longer. We don't use scrolls anymore that you have to turn. We use pages. Why don't we use pages on computer interfaces? I don't know. But if we're going to use documents that are longer than the reviewing window, I need something to navigate. By making this abstract operation of navigating an object that I can manipulate with my mouse, I turn it into a concrete instrument that I use to, not for the simple purpose of moving the thumb, but to navigate something. So it's mediating my interaction. And it allows me to do things that I couldn't do if I only had the mouse, or maybe not as well. When I interact with an instrument, I get immediate feedback. Well, first I'm moving the mouse and I get the tactile feedback, but I also get the feedback of where I am here in the scroll bar. And then the instrument itself operates on an object, here a document, and I can see that object move, so I get what I call a response.
So that's the thing with instrumental interaction, is you have two loops. You have you with the tool you're using, and there's the tool with the object and back to you.
One way to look at it, if you remember the discussion over modes the other day, is that an instrument turns a mode into something concrete. And people like concrete things. They like things on the screen that they can go click at and it does something. They like objects in the real world that have affordances telling you what they're able to do. So the reason why these tool palettes are so popular is because they use this metaphor. But there are many things that you don't do with tool palettes
or equivalent approaches that are, you know, sprinkled in menus. A menu is not a good instrument. I mean, it's a good instrument when you're in a restaurant, but I don't think it's a good instrument when you are on the computer. So I'm going very quickly here, but if you're interested, I'll put the references to the papers. You can actually analyze existing instruments
as a set, existing interfaces as a set of instruments. Why do we have title bars and windows?
I mean, yes, it's to display the title, but frankly, that's not the main purpose. The main purpose is to give you a place where you know you can move this window around. And when you have windows without a frame, you are confused.
And even though oftentimes you can move them by clicking inside of them,
you don't have the affordance for it. I talked about menu scroll bars.
I mean, these property boxes or data boxes are instruments, but they're really clumsy. They're not really adapted to the task the way a physical instrument in the real world is.
But there are many more interaction techniques that you could describe as instruments.
The tool glasses I mentioned before are a perfect example of a real instrument that is inspired by the real world and transposed to the digital world in a way that is clever. Because it doesn't work exactly like the real thing. It allows me to do things that are more powerful. By just moving this over the object, I have a very natural way of applying a command to an object without having to select the object in advance. That's how I get rid of selection. And selection is not something natural. So if we can get rid of it, it's probably a good thing. Even if you look at, some of you will take the class on tangible interfaces, and you've seen some things maybe in augmented and mixed reality, you can interpret a lot of the things in terms of instruments and tools. In tangible interfaces, you use physical devices, like here, this physical handle, like a brick, that you put on an object to move the object. Well, this is really consistent with the notion of instrumental interaction. And once you have instruments, you can start looking at how can I use instruments to compare things together. One property, for example, is the degree of interaction. What is what I call the spatial and temporal offset between your action on the object, on the instrument, and the action of the instrument on the object. And here you can see that handles are down here. Short spatial offset, handles are next to the object I'm manipulating, whereas property box can be arbitrarily far away. Handles, as they move the handle, the object reacts, so short temporal offset, immediate action. Whereas something like a drag and drop, I have to wait until I'm completely done to see what happens. So you can compare things. I'm not saying that everything has to be done here. As I've said before, I think,
you know, it's nice that the switch is next to the door even though the light is up here.
So sometimes I want to be here, sometimes I want to be here. But at least by mapping things like this, I can make informed choices. I have a tool, in fact, to help myself make decisions. Another property is the degree of integration. How well am I using what the user is giving me? This, you know, refers to what we were talking about earlier on information. A scroll bar is really a poor device. It forces me to do 2D interaction and uses 1D. In the Bryce interface, there was this thing. This is an amazing device because it uses 2 degrees of freedom of my mouse and allows me to control the object in 3D. So I'm gaining a degree of freedom here somehow. Not exactly, of course. There's no magic there. But at least I can control a 3D angle of view with a 2D device in a way that is intuitive. So it's got to be a better instrument. And the degree of conformance is when we use physical objects as instruments, their mode of operation oftentimes is transparent. When I use a screwdriver, I know how it works, or if it doesn't work, I can tell if it fits the screw. Now, sophisticated instruments tend to be less transparent and people don't understand them. And if you don't understand why it works, usually you don't use it as well. So if it's hard to read how the instrument works, it's probably less good. So we talked about this problem with scroll bars that you have to move down to move up, whereas if you use the little hand here, it's more natural that it's more predictable. But similarly, if you use a dialog box, it's very an abstract representation of what you're doing, whereas if you're using a handle, it's more direct. But again, sometimes you want to be doing this because you know that you need font size 24 because that's what the instructions tell you to do. So again, these are not always to say one is better in absolute terms, but instead one, you know, you can compare them. And that gets me to the three design principles. Because once you think, okay, I'm going to build an interface based on instruments, well, where do these instruments come from? Well, you can imagine that over time, you know, some things will become more or less standard. The scroll bar is already a standard way to move an object. What we found is that if you had design principles, we get to this generative aspect I was talking about. It helps us imagine new solutions we hadn't thought about. I don't want to bore you with those fancy terms, but I would like to show you a few examples. Search. Well, if you look at the classic search tool, no surprise, you have a find command somewhere in the menu, it brings a dialog box, you have to fill the dialog box, and you have to click buttons. And what this does usually is allow you to find the next occurrence of something and cycle through them by clicking next, next, next. Well, this is not how I think of searching. If I think of searching, the focus is not on what I'm typing in here, really. It's on what is the effect. So what I want is to be able to see immediately as I type something, all the occurrences show up. Now, you've seen this now in some web browsers and in some text editors. I think David showed you a Sublime Text that has this fancy stuff. So, but it's something I did 14 years ago. So at the time, it was a bit more exotic. But it's not the point. The point is, if I'm thinking of the search task as, okay, what would be a good instrument for doing this, I come up with this idea. And if others have come up with the same idea, I'm glad. And the idea here is that you highlight all the occurrences, you show them in a scroll bar so that those that are outside of view are still visible, so you can see how many hits you get. But then I can go further, I can say, well, if I replace thing, I can type a replace string here, and then I can tap the occurrences that I want to replace. And they show up in red here, replace instrument with tool, I can see the effect.
And so, time and again, what we've seen is, if you think with this notion of making the instrument explicit, which is what I call reification, you will get simpler interactions that give you more power. So I have effectively shifted the curve, as I was talking about before.
Here, there are things you can do in terms of search and replace that you cannot do with this kind of interface. This interface forces you the order in which to do things. Here, you do it in the order you want. Here, you see the magnitude. I was editing a book and I had to create an index. I had to decide which words would be in the index. With this, I could see immediately when I type a word how many occurrences there is. So I was using it for something which was not really just a finding task, but a different task.
So reification is really this notion that something normally quite abstract, you turn into a concrete instrument visible to the user. And polymorphism is the idea that you take an object and you make it, you take an instrument, you make it so it can work with objects of many different types. So you increase its power. So I want to show here the example with the magnetic guidelines.
When we created this tool for PetriNet editing, we observed users. They were spending 20% of the time aligning things together. It's like a programmer being in a text editor where you have to put all the spaces for indentation yourself. And we asked them, how much time do you think you spend doing this? They said, maybe 5% at most. But we had video data to show them that, no, they were spending 20% of the time.
And so we said, well, we need to make this better in our new tool.
And again, if you think of an alignment command, usually you have to select multiple objects. You go into a menu, you say align, you have this dialog box that shows up with things you don't understand really. You click, align left, right, center. You say okay, all the things get crumpled together, and you say, oh shit, I have to start over again. Right?
Well, what would be an aligning instrument? Well, the thing for sure is I'm not going to have a command with a dialog box. But if I want to align things, I want to align them to something. So why not make this something visible and explicit?
Well, this is what I call a guideline. So I create this object. So instead of having an align command, I have a create an alignment object.
And that can be my palette. In the same way I have things for creating rectangles and circles and other things, I have a new object in my drawing.
And that's an alignment. And you have to think of it as an instrument because it's a little bit like a...